Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Harner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the conference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you'll be able to ask questions of today's presenters. A handout for today's seminar is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources, and finally click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you will find a link for the handout. Again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center, then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources, and finally, click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you will find the link for today's handout. And today I have the pleasure of introducing Karen Bierbauer and Elisha Kontner from the Blue Horizon Center. Karen is the clinical director, and Elisha is the program director at Blue Horizon. Today they'll be sharing information with us on emerging trends in eating disorders.
Thank you, Kate. I'd like to first on slide two go over some of our basic objectives for today. One is to understand the basic diagnoses in eating disorder treatment. Also understand the media coined terminology, which we refer to as the emerging trends. Provide definitions, statistics, and care plan information for the emerging trends, as well as to provide education on eating disorders in the pediatric population. What we're first going to do is go over just some of the basic diagnostic categories in eating disorder treatment. Anorexia nervosa characteristics are taken from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Body weight 15% below ideal body weight, loss of menstrual cycle, intense fear of weight gain, distorted body image, unusual eating behaviors, intense preoccupation with food, weight, and body image, as well as depression and social isolation. In bulimia nervosa, we see recurrent episodes of binge eating. Binge eating is defined as eating in a discrete period of time, typically a two-hour period of time, an amount of food greater than most people would eat under the same conditions. Bulimia also consists of self-induced vomiting, laxative use, excessive exercise, strict dieting, fasting, following binge episodes. Again, as with anorexia nervosa, there is an intense fear of weight gain. Secretive behavior around food and eating. For instance, with bulimia nervosa, it is much easier to hide bulimia based on some of the physical traits being not as blatant as with anorexia nervosa. Persistent overconcern with weight and appearance, as well as depression and moodiness. If you look on the next slide, this is what we call eating disorder not otherwise specified, sometimes referred to as EDNOS. This is the largest diagnostic category that we see, and basically it is a category for those who do not meet the full criteria for either anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. For instance, one may have all the symptoms of anorexia nervosa, except their current weight may be in the normal range. There may be the absence of a period. All criteria for bulimia nervosa, but the frequency of binges or compensatory behaviors, those are the behaviors referring to purging, do not meet frequency criteria or last less than 3 months. Binge eating disorder, recurrent episodes of binge eating in the absence of regular other inappropriate compensatory behaviors characteristic of bulimia nervosa. Currently, binge eating disorder falls under the category of eating disorder not otherwise specified, but due to the increase in this particular diagnosis, it will be its own diagnosis in the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. On slide six, frequency of eating disorders, we just want to share some statistics with you today. Eating disorders affect 5 to 10% of females in the United States. Eating disorders affect all socioeconomic groups. In adults, there is a 40-to-1 ratio of females to males. We are seeing an increase currently in males, including boys and men with eating disorders. In adolescents, we're seeing a 10-to-1 female-to-male ratio. And in children, between the ages of 5 and 12, we're seeing a 5-to-1 female-to-male ratio. Continuing on with statistics, approximately 5 to 17 million people suffer from anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. Approximately 90% of those are women. 43% report the age of onset between 16 and 20 years old. 86% report the age of onset by the age of 20. We are also seeing an increase of women in midlife with eating disorders, midlife being defined between the ages of 30 and 65. During the early 80s, the average age of onset increased from 19.3 to 22.2. The incidence of bulimia nervosa in women ages 10 to 39 tripled between 1988 and 1993. Anorexia is more common in women between the ages of 25 to 35. The majority of patients with bulimia nervosa are in their 20s. Dr. Richard Kreitz, a specialist in adolescent medicine, says that the number of patients with eating disorder not otherwise specified has almost doubled nationally. Presently, this consists of 75% of eating disorder cases. Disordered eating is an eating disorder that does not fit the specific criteria of anorexia or bulimia, but may include drastic restriction, binging, and purging as previously defined. So that is just some basic information on some of the classic diagnostic categories of eating disorders, but today what we are going to focus on is the emerging trends that we are seeing in the eating disorder field. Some of the trends that we are going to go over today are terms that were coined by the media. So these do not represent a specific diagnostic category in the diagnostic manual that I previously referred to. Some of the trends that we will focus on today include diabulimia, drunkorexia, orthorexia, eating disorders in males, including muscle dysmorphia, bigorexia, and reverse anorexia. And then we're also going to focus on eating disorders in the childbearing years, as previously referred to, the increase of eating disorders in midlife, such as pregorexia and the desperate housewife syndrome.
Hey, this is Karen Bierbauer, and I'm starting off as a slide entitled Diabulimia. I'm going to just give you a few minutes and some information on this rather disturbing condition as one of the emerging trends. Diabulimia is actually not a new emerging trend. Many diabetics actually have known about this kind of phenomenon or behavior that they could get engaged with in order to manipulate their weight, but it actually has just become recognized as a term and recognized within the eating disorder world as something that needs to be addressed. And what diabulimia refers to is that people with type 1, which are the insulin-dependent diabetic, who will intentionally avoid taking their insulin in an attempt to stay or become thin. And a person is diagnosed at a very young age as diabetic, they are usually very underweight, and then because the cells are starving, because they're not receiving the glucose, the insulin isn't there to take the glucose into the cell. So that when they're diagnosed and given insulin, then all of a sudden the cells receive the glucose, they become moving towards, become nourished, and then they move towards ideal body weight. So that the diabetic learns that it is the insulin that is responsible for the weight gain, so that as they get older, they tend to use the insulin as a form of purging, and then they can eat, not take their insulin, and then those calories do not go into the cell, so they use that as a form of purging. The problems and the health consequences associated with that behavior are kidney failure, heart disease, neuropathy, circulatory difficulties, and retinopathy, which is problems with the eyes. And again, those are all health consequences also associated with straight diabetes, but they're magnified in those with eating disorders as well. But this is the most disturbing rates that we have, and those are the mortality rates. 2.5% for type 1 diabetics, 6.5% for anorexia nervosa. But then when you look at the concurrent diagnosis of type 1 diabetes and anorexia, the mortality rate jumps to 34.8%. So what the care plan for this particular emerging trend in eating disorder needs to be is one that includes an endocrinologist on the care team. And that's when that care team needs individualized regular follow-up blood work, a nutrition care plan to include the diabetic management as well as the eating disorder management, and then the therapy to include acceptance of a chronic disease and an identity outside of the disease, along with the social barriers associated with being diabetic and empowerment with the diabetes. So in our treatment with these patients, it's helping them understand that, yes, you have two diseases, one that can be completely treated, which is the eating disorder, and one that is chronic, and that there has to be some learned acceptance of the chronicity of that disease, and that is the diabetes. So the therapy work in that patient becomes very, very complex.
We are now on slide 14, and I'm going to cover drunkorexia. I think the first time that I heard about drunkorexia was within the last 10 years. And when we think of this term drunkorexia, we usually associate it with the college-age population. Drunkorexia consists of self-imposed starvation or binging and purging combined with alcohol abuse. It is a slightly misleading term, as alcohol abuse is more common with bulimia. And because an anorexic has that fear of weight gain, an anorexic certainly is going to be more leery of consuming alcohol due to the calories that the alcohol consists of. Alcohol, for instance, may be the only calories consumed all day. So what somebody that has drunkorexia tends to do is, if it is a college student and they know that night they are going to be going out with their friends, they will restrict their food intake all day, because they know that the calories that they are going to get later that evening is going to come from alcohol. So if you think about it, if they have not had any food or any nutritional consumption all day, the alcohol is going to take effect on the body a lot quicker than if they had consumed some food. So the alcohol may be a way to very quickly numb some emotional pain. It may also be used as a method to manage weight and to continue drinking. So the drunkorexics, for instance, will, again, either not consume any food all day so that they can consume calories based on alcohol later in the evening, or the other thing that we're also seeing is that with the bulimic type, they tend to go and binge food, but then use the alcohol as an excuse to purge. Prevalent in college-age binge drinkers who often starve during the day to offset calories through alcohol and decrease time to feel the effects. Bulimics typically binge on food and alcohol and follow with the purge. They use the alcohol, for instance, as a way to justify the purge. Well, it wasn't that I went and purged my food. I drank so much last night, and that is why I vomited, and that is why I got sick. Anorexics use alcohol to ease anxiety around food or being in uncomfortable food environments. So what anorexics will do, because alcohol tends to lower the inhibitions, if they are uncomfortable around the food and they're in that social setting and they fear not consuming food in front of their friends, they will use some of that alcohol to relax so that they can consume food and also be in that social environment. Again, we are going to see an increase in health risks, not only due to the binging and purging behaviors, but also coupled with the potential consequences of alcohol abuse. We'll see a restriction of necessary nutrients, disrupted sleep cycles. Alcohol will interfere with their REM sleep cycles, inhibited building and restoration of muscle tissue, irritation of the stomach lining with increased risk of ulcers, and less overall tolerance to alcohol with restricted food intake. In recent studies, alcohol problems occur in 9 to 55% of bulimics versus 0 to 19% of anorexics. There is a positive correlation with development of alcohol use disorders in those with eating disorders. Very often with clients I work with, if they're not using their eating disorder as a coping skill, then they may be using the alcohol and vice versa. Purgers report a heavier alcohol consumption than non-purgers. Their mindset is that they know at some point that they will rid their bodies of the alcohol. And there's also a positive correlation between severe dieting and prevalence and intensity of alcohol use. Drunkorexia does not carry any official statistics. However, CBS News has estimated that drunkorexia affects 30% of 18 to 23-year-olds. So we are seeing those numbers increase on college campuses throughout our nation. A care plan for those afflicted with drunkorexia will include nutrition and psychoeducation, reference the dangers of this behavior. So not only do we need to educate them on the consequences or the potential consequences of an eating disorder, but we also need to educate them on the potential consequences of excessive alcohol consumption. We need to move these individuals towards a normal relationship with food. We also need to help them find alternative methods to relax, as well as develop more positive coping skills besides using alcohol, as well as therapy to address the addiction simultaneously, depending on the therapeutic model used. There are some practitioners who believe that the addiction is better off being treated first rather in conjunction with the eating disorder. Our philosophy is that the addiction should be treated simultaneously. The next emerging trend that we're going to take a look at is orthorexia. And one of the things that kind of you can relate to orthorexia, if you remember the macrobiotic diets of the 70s, where people felt that there was no food that was clean enough or perfect enough or safe enough to eat, and they ended up eating a lot of brown rice and then just died. So that was kind of the closest thing to orthorexia, whereas this population believes that no food, again, is healthy enough. And so by getting so wrapped up into that belief system, they end up slowly and slowly taking more and more foods out of their food repertoire and end up with the same symptoms of anorexia nervosa or self-starvation. What they deny is that they have any concerns about body image or a desire to lose weight. Rather, their sole concern is that the food is unhealthy. So it is a newer form of a disordered eating. It was featured on a 2020 series several years ago. Some of you might have seen it. It was with John Stossel, did an interview on it. But it is a fixation on eating healthy and only pure foods. And the restriction is based on the perceived quality of that food, with slowly and slowly taking more and more foods out of the diet. Some warning signs of this are spending more than 3 hours per day thinking about healthy food. Where is that going to come from? How am I going to find the foods that I need? And then obviously becoming very obsessive with the quality of the food that they're eating. Feeling very virtuous about food, but not enjoying it because of the fear that what they're taking in could actually make them, quote, unhealthy. Continually eliminating acceptable food. So it may start out with a vegetarian diet and then go to a vegan diet, and then everything has to be organic and raw, and then pretty soon there can't be any type of processing, or it can't be cooked in certain types of pans, or, on and on and on. And there's also very
kind of cult-like group that will prepare their food together in order to carry out these rituals and kind of bond with people who have these same beliefs, because obviously you have this social isolation because of this. Critical of others who do not eat the same way, elimination of foods that they did once enjoy, guilt or self-loathing if they stray away from their diet, and then feeling in total control if their food is correct in their mind. How this is disordered is because the food does become the primary focus in their life, taking hours and hours to prepare their food for the day, causing social isolation or excessive exercise to balance out their eating if they feel that they have to get rid of anything that they took in that was unhealthy, and often leads to, obviously, to malnutrition through the restriction of fat, preservatives, animal products, raw foods, and them not being able to get in the normal food supply the foods that they feel are approved. But again, they deny that there is any desire to lose weight based on don't have the feeling of being fat or think that they're fat, and yet they are very thin and often malnourished. The next eating disorder that we're going to talk about is the eating disorder that is affecting the male population, and as Alicia said, this is the area that just keeps growing. And this terminology, again, these are terms when we talk about emerging trends. We're not talking about the terminology that you're going to see in the DSM categories in terms of professional literature, but we're talking about the terms that you're going to see in the New York Times, that you're going to see in the magazines, that you're going to hear on 2020 and in the news. These are muscle dysmorphia, bigorexia, reverse anorexia, and again, binge eating disorder in this population. These are the eating disorders that are prominently right now in the male population, and we're going to take a look at what is going on in this group and why are we in this place today. The estimates today are that the National Institute of Mental Health reports in 2008 over 1 million men with eating disorders. The Harvard study estimates 25% of eating disordered adults are male, and there's been a 250% increase in men and a 10 to 25% projected increase over the next 10 years. So this is where we're at. This is where it's going. So you're going to see more of this in the literature and in the news. Why is this increase happening? A lot of it is what is going on in our culture, and that our culture is placing more emphasis on the male body and the male body image. The advertising is responsible for a lot of this. The male body in advertising right now is worth billions, and not only in the adult population, but when you look in, it even comes down into what's happening with children's toys and things like that. We'll talk about that in a minute. But if you look in just in your drugstores, in your grocery stores, go down the magazine aisle, and where you used to see quite a few of the magazines focusing on, of course, women and women's shape and women's body image, now you have quite a few of them also focusing on the male body and what is perfection in the male body and the male body image. You also have that in the action figures. So that used to be all the emphasis was on the change in the Barbie doll. Well, now they've looked at Superman, G.I. Joe, Spider-Man. All of those action figure dolls have changed. Now they have biceps, they have skinnier waists, and they have six-packs. And so even the younger boys are looking at those male body images differently than they did before. Male models have grown increasingly more lean and muscular over the last 25 years. So my guess is there's many more men feeling more uncomfortable taking their T-shirts off at the beach than there were 10 years ago. What we're also finding in males is that males are more likely to become obese and then teased when they are young. Now, again, if what we know about the human body is that you have to gain weight before you gain height. So children and boys that are destined to be 6'1 or 6'2 most likely can go through a childhood adolescent phase where they might appear to be chubby or have a little weight on them to prepare them to be very tall as an adult. And again, they may be perceived at that time to be more overweight and teased about that. There's not a lot of tolerance anymore for people to go through adolescence and the changes that that demands. We're supposed to always look good and have these perfect bodies from ages like 8 right on through adulthood, and it seems not real fair. We're looking at diets to achieve muscular bodies are very prevalent in the male-directed magazines, increased gender identity issues, decreased sexual activity, increased sexual abuse, increase in weight-related sports, and what we talk about in those in that category is going to be, of course, wrestling in males. It may be rowing or crew where you're trying to make weight to be in a lightweight boat, gymnastics, some in the male ice skating profession, those types of professions where weight is a factor. Also, findings in males in these categories and associations is separation or loss of the father in the family. In addition, we're finding body checking is a major behavior in this category, with males looking in the mirror over 50 times per day and yet not necessarily liking what they see, even though they may have attained a very admirable shape and physique. When other men are looking at them or people and think they look great, they don't feel that way. 90% of their time is reported thinking about working out, as well as when and what to eat and the amount of protein that they will eat. Very obsessed with that category. They do not see themselves as others see them and never believe themselves to be quite fit enough. The other issues that you have is that they will also work out when they don't feel well and make it to the gym no matter what. Gender differences, and this is quite interesting, in terms of body dissatisfaction, equal percentage of men and women are unhappy with their bodies. Women have a drive for thinness, where men have a drive more towards muscularity. Women are more dissatisfied about their bodies from the waist down. Men tend to be more dissatisfied of their bodies from the waist up. In addition, in terms of the compensatory behaviors and methods that they use, men are more likely to use excessive exercise as a way to develop more muscle mass in their minds or to rid themselves of what they believe of excessive calories. Women are more likely to use the behavior of self-induced vomiting, and men are less likely to use laxatives. As far as a care plan, when we look at this group of individuals, we need to work towards appropriate weight restoration. And again, weight restoration does not always mean just gaining weight, but gaining weight in a healthy way and getting a body composition that's realistic and healthy and one that a person can comfortably maintain with a more moderate, healthy exercise plan. So it's looking at body comp, not just the scale weight. We want to try to disrupt maladaptive behaviors and kind of compulsive type behaviors, treat comorbidities as they occur within all the populations of eating disorders, screen for those and get those treated appropriately through the therapy modalities, challenge irrational thought patterns, and then address male-specific issues. And I'm really going to emphasize that because Alicia and I, our program presently is taking data on this population, but it's very, very important when you're assessing males in this category that you're making sure that you get them the help that's appropriate for males and in programs and with professionals that know how to treat and address the male population and the problems that are specific to them. That's the most important thing that we can do for that group right now.
We're going to shift gears again back to females and just give everybody a minute to check in. We are now on slide 31. I'm going to focus on eating disorders in the childbearing years. And if you remember back to when I spoke earlier, this is a population in which we are seeing eating disorders on the rise. This is those women between the ages of 30 and 65. Some of the media coined terms in this category include pregorexia, desperate housewife syndrome, and if you look at the picture on this slide, that term was obviously coined by the Desperate Housewives show that is on, I believe, ABC on Sunday evenings. Women also in this age category are plagued by cyclic dieting, and some of these women as well have a lack of female role models. The first term we're going to cover is pregorexia. In working with women with eating disorders in the past, it used to be that when a woman who had battled an eating disorder became pregnant, she would immediately cease those behaviors. But that is a trend that we are no longer seeing with this population. Pregorexia consists of anorexic or bulimic behaviors that occur during and after pregnancy, associated with the unnatural desire not to gain the 25 to 35 suggested pounds. So these women are really trying to battle the fact that while they're pregnant, they're expected to gain this weight to have a healthy pregnancy. Pregorexia is now affecting 5% of women, and it's marked by weight control through extreme dieting and over-exercising while pregnant. Pregorexia is also reinforced by comments about weight from friends and family. So, for instance, if a family member says to a woman who's pregnant, wow, you're gaining weight very quickly with this pregnancy, if a woman has struggled with weight concerns and body image over the years, she's going to perceive that as a negative comment and then do anything that she can in her power to change that perception. The root of the disorder is based in control, perfectionism, or using this disorder as a coping mechanism to deal with difficult emotions and experience. So just as many of our clients develop an eating disorder as a coping skill, as a way to deal with stress, women in this population are not only dealing with the fact that their body is changing, but they're also maybe dealing with that life transition into parenthood for the very first time. Due to the pregnancy, they're dealing with the hormonal changes, the physical changes, as well as some of the emotional changes. So this can be a very stressful time, and if they've used an eating disorder in the past as a coping skill, this may then, because of these additional stressors, may be something that they go back to. Studies have focused on binge eating episodes are the most prevalent eating disorder behaviors reported during the gestational period, occurring in 25 to 44% in women during their first pregnancy. Women with bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, or high levels of perfectionism are at higher risk of developing postpartum depression. Health risks associated with engaging in an eating disorder during pregnancy include, for instance, anemia. This is the diminished capacity of blood to carry oxygen. So a child that is born potentially with anemia is prone more to infections and learning disabilities. ADHD is also the possibility. Children born from mothers who have had an eating disorder have an increased potential to develop ADHD. And that is because of some of the chemical imbalances that the mother then passes on to the child. Rickets, that is a vitamin D deficiency that results in weak, soft bones, along with slowed growth and skeletal development. There's also a risk of heart disease. And for these children as well, there's also a risk of poor growth and cognitive development. So their brain growth may in some ways be stunted, and they may have some signs of developmental delays. Additional health risks for these children, there is a high risk of miscarriage and preterm delivery. Microcephaly, this is a neurodevelopmental disorder in which the head is more than 2 standard deviations smaller than the average for the person's age and sex. There's a risk of gestational diabetes, hypertension, a higher rate of C-section delivery, and low Apgar scores. This is a test that's given to an infant following 1 minute after birth and then 5 minutes after birth. And what this test looks at is appearance, pulse, reflexes, activity, and respiration. And in children born to mothers who did continue the eating disorder during the pregnancy, we are going to see that these numbers are slightly lower. Recommendations for working with this population. Patients with eating disorders counseled not to conceive until the eating disorder is in remission. We need to develop some clearer guidelines for obstetricians, and that's one of the things that we are doing here in our community is really getting out and working with our physicians and educating them on the risks associated with eating disorders. The individual needs to have a treatment team that consists of her obstetrician, a dietitian, a therapist, a psychiatrist, family members, spouse, significant other, and friends. And it would behoove the female as well to look for a possible support group in her area, as well to deal with some of the associated stressors of possibly being a mother for the first time. And then moving on, we're just briefly going to look at the desperate housewife syndrome. And we're going to look at a quote by Margot Main. She is a pioneer and a researcher in the eating disorder field. Age does not immunize women from body image preoccupation and weight concerns, as has been thought in the past. In fact, disordered eating and a fear of aging go hand in hand for many women. There is a majority of women in our society have body image concerns. And again, if you are familiar with the Desperate Housewives show and you think back to that show, women in our culture are turning to eating disorders to cope with a fear of aging. As Karen mentioned, we are seeing those types of issues occurring in the media. The media and television are really promoting maintaining a youthful appearance at any cost.
The last the slide regarding emerging trend that we're going to cover is basically just a mention, and that is patterns of feeding disorders that are specific to the pediatric population. We're not going to go into these in detail other than to say that we categorize these as an emerging trend because the age of eating disorders keeps getting younger and younger. And it is a concern for pediatricians. One of the basic steps of education that the Academy of Eating Disorders, which is an international organization, their target group is for first emergency room physicians and then pediatricians in terms of education, because we want to get screening done at that very, very early age. So some of it is looking at, we know that there are feeding problems in kids. And it's looking at what is a feeding problem in a child and when does a feeding problem become an eating disorder. And all that is on this one slide is basically a listing of what we know are feeding problems in the pediatric population. Food refusal syndrome, functional dysphagia, food avoidance emotional disorder, selective eating and extreme fad dieting, pervasive refusal syndrome, which is not only refusing food but refusing going to bed on time and refusing other basic disciplines and schedules and routines like going to school or getting dressed or things like that, and then other forms of restrictive eating. I'm not going to get into details with these today, but what I'm going to say is that most pediatricians recognize these feeding problems, and they would screen for these. If they felt like that these were present, but they could be more extensive than just a simple childhood or toddler phase, and that it could go into an eating disorder. They may make the recommendation to go to a dietitian, possibly offer make the offer to go to a therapist and take a look at these behaviors and see if they've kind of crossed over into that eating disorder mark. And how we know that is if the feeding disorder goes to the point where it started to affect normal growth and development, then it has become an eating disorder and needs more long-term work and therapy. So that's kind of a guideline that we want to keep in mind for that population. The next slide that we're looking at basically is as to terms of where do we go from here. And what we do need to do is continue in the education arena, educating just our community, individuals, professionals that we're working with, that the risks of eating disorders are out there, and whether it's in the school population that you're working with or have access to in your community, in single groups, whether it's working with girls or boys with sports, Girl Scouts, whatever, knowing that these are discussions that could be out there and how we can get involved. Professionals in the eating disorder field need to stay current with the research and media trends, need to provide education for families and friends, and support groups for family and friends that are out there. You want to take advantage at every turn that you can. We offer them free, and there's in many, many communities we know of that they're out there. You just have to seek them. If you have the strength and ability to sustain an eating disorder, then you have the strength and ability to move beyond it. We do believe in full recovery, but that can be a 2 to 6 year process or longer. And so sometimes it takes many disciplines and many stages of that. But we hope that through these types of seminars, you're going to be able to get at least some base information to get you motivated, stimulated, and provide you the direction of where to get that care and to seek out more treatment and more help. And the last slide is just for additional information on a contact for us and how we can be of further information to you and as a resource and referral, and then also, as they said, through Cigna and their website as well. And with that, Alicia and I thank you very much for your attention and look forward to hearing your questions.
And at this time, we will conduct a brief electronic survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Our first question, this session provided me with a better understanding of emerging trends in the field of eating disorders. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. And we will pause for a moment to tally the responses. And moving to our second question. This session educated me on eating disorder diagnoses as well as media coin terminology. That's star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. And we'll pause again. And our third question, overall this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. And for question four, I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you disagree. And our last question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or star 4, for other. And that does conclude today's survey. At this time, we'd like to go into our question and answer session. To ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1, and we will pause to assemble the queue. And we'll now take our first question.
Hi, my name is Joan, and I'm a behavioral clinician here. And coaching a father who's calling about stress, and I'm curious, his 15-year-old daughter has been through the gamut of treatment options, inpatient, outpatient, and he's just wanting some resources at this time. They're starting family counseling, but I'm wanting to just send him some good, whether it be websites, books. What do you recommend for someone who's really gone through a lot but still feels like they're really struggling?
For websites, I would certainly recommend edreferral.com, as well as the Academy for Eating Disorders.
Okay.
National Eating Disorders also has a parent toolkit on there. It's about a 50-page document, and it covers the gamut, everything from psychoeducation all the way to how to navigate your insurance. If you've ever had any issues with insurance being denied, there's samples of appeal letters in there that he can utilize. That is certainly an excellent resource, one that we recommend in our family support group that we have here.
Okay.
And I would say for him, too, I know you mentioned that they're going to be in family counseling, but, you know, I know for the families, too, that this really is not just an illness that affects the individual, but it really affects the entire family. I would say even for the father or the parents, you know, just to have their own counseling, too.
Yeah.
To kind of deal with some of the emotional issues that arise.
Right. Okay, thank you.
The NIDA organization also, because they have a family track, he can reach out to them because they have, that he can become a member just being a family and then talk to other people within that organization that are dealing with the same problems he is as well.
Thank you.
NIDA is the only organization that does offer a family track as well. So at their national conference, which this year is going to be in October in St. Petersburg, Florida, they do have a family track. So if the father wanted to attend that conference to get additional information, he would just attend that parent track.
Super. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And as a reminder, that is star 1 to queue for questions, and we'll now take our next question.
Hi, my name is Nikki, and I'm a behavioral clinician here. I just wanted to say thank you and just give some feedback about how much I enjoyed the presentation. And I also just wanted to know if there was somewhere where feedback could be left about the presentation, a suggestion or something along those lines.
If you want to use our email, info@bluehorizoned.com, that would be
And that would be an appropriate place. The right person related to this seminar would get that?
Yeah, that can be forwarded to us. Absolutely.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'll also add, this is Kate Harner speaking again, just as the representative from the eating disorder team here at Cigna. If you have that feedback that you particularly enjoyed certain presenters, feel free to send that information to me as well so we can be sure to try to get these ladies to do another talk for us.
We'd love to.
And we have no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, I'll just say thank you to everyone for attending, and thank you also to Karen and Elisha for providing such wonderful insights for all of us. If anyone has specific questions about anything discussed in today's presentation, please feel free to contact the eating disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. And please be sure to mark your calendars to join our eating disorder awareness seminar next month on Tuesday, May 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.